Monday, the 12th of February. This is the House Resources Committee. I'd like to call this meeting of the committee to order at 1:05. Members present are Representative Birch, Representative Drummond, Representative Johnson, Representative Parrish, Representative Tallarico, Vice Chair Representative Lincoln, and the co-chairs Representative Tarr and myself, Representative Josephson. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Deborah Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Eileen Keim. I remind members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. Today, we will consider amendments to House Bill 322. Then we'll hear a presentation from representatives of the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association about contaminated Alaska Native Corporation lands. Do members have any questions before we turn to House Bill 322? Seeing none, I note that the Director of DEC's Division of Spill Prevention and Response, Kristen Ryan, and I'll confirm, yep, that she is online to answer questions as we debate amendments. So with that, I can confirm for you that the amendments that I have before me and that you have before you, you should have a copy of five amendments, were filed or requested, rather, by Sunday at 5, which were my instructions, and you now have them. So with that, we have amendment number one, Representative Parrish.
Mr. Chair, I move amendment number one.
Is there an objection to amendment number one?
I'll object.
Okay. There's an objection, so Representative Parrish, would you speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment simply brings the penalties up to the amounts that they would be at if we'd kept up with inflation. I think inflation is a thief that comes in the night, and any chance we get to smack it in the nose, I think, ought to be taken.
Any other discussion relative to amendment number one? Seeing none, is the objection maintained to amendment number one?
I'll maintain my objection.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right, so we have an objected to amendment, and at this point I take the roll or request that the roll be taken. Ms. Tillinghast, will you call the roll?
Representative Tallarico?
No.
Representative Lincoln?
No.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Yes.
Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Rapture is not present. Representative Jefferson?
Yes.
Representative Todd?
Yes.
So the amendment fails. We will now move to amendment number two by Representative Parrish. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number two.
Is there an objection to amendment number two?
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to speak to your objection? And I apologize that I didn't do that before, but you surely knew that you could have.
I did, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Thank you very much, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman, and I did realize that. I apologize for not speaking my objection.
You're fine.
I should have. Mr. Chairman, I just, after quite a bit of testimony and everything, I know that the onus to clean up a spill after one has been put out there is really on the let me use the right term here, on the responsibility of the company and the people that actually put out the spill. I really, when I look at our fee structure and everything, I think that that's put in place to cover our cost. I think generally if, and this is just my opinion, Mr. Chairman, but generally if you look at it, there are very few people that are out there that see any advantage to spilling a cash product that they're trying to transport, and since they have the responsibility of the cleanup fees and everything, I personally just don't see the increase in these fees to cover our expenses. We do have things in place that require these people to actually do this and do it appropriately. So that's probably why I don't support these particular increases in the fees. I know that the fees were laid out in the bill that was introduced as well, and which I believe were increases from the current fees, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chairman. So that's really the point of my objection.
Sure.
Thank you.
You bet. Any other comments about Amendment Number 2, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And perhaps Ms. Ryan could just confirm this on the phone, please. For Amendment Number 2, we're looking at page 4, lines 7. And this is a circumstance where the company has been found via civil action to be liable. And so this is, you know, a circumstance where I guess the information presented would be sufficient to say that they had acted irresponsibly, and that is what caused the spill. So is that, could you please confirm that that's what would be happening here with these amounts?
For the record, this is Kristen Ryan, the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the state of Alaska. And yes, that's correct, Representative Tarr. That penalty would come into effect once the state had found that the spiller had harmed the environment in a way that warranted a penalty.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the same theme, this amendment is meant to keep the inflation-adjusted value of the fines the same as they were when they were originally set forth, 40 years ago?
Some of them, yes.
I think that it's sensible that they should be adjusted. I believe that if in criminal codes we talked about positive reinforcement as being the only appropriate response to misbehaving, we would be laughed out of office. I think that there is a place for civil penalties to deter noncompliance. It's the responsibility of any given company to assure a maximum return to its investors. That's about the end of their official responsibility. And I think it's part of our job to make sure that the public is protected, to make sure that our waters are protected, our game is protected, and that we leave a high-quality environment for future generations. Thus, I'm in favor of keeping civil penalties from eroding in the case of misbehavior or violations of the law by anyone in the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Any other comments about Amendment 2? I will take an opportunity to make one myself. One of the things that Kara Moriarty testified to on Friday, and I heard her, I heard the audio of that hearing, and she noted that depending on the fiscal year, the number of spills that belong to the oil and gas industry are in the 24% to 29% range. But in terms of volume, they're only in the 2% range. And so I'm not sure, with great respect for former Chairman Tallarico, my concern is, and by the way, she said this, my concern is that other industries are not paying their cleanup. In fact, the cost is being borne by the oil industry through the SPAR fund. What she said, and I think I have it here, Ms. Moriarty said, was essentially that. Here's what she said an hour and 2 minutes into our meeting. DEC usually recovers full costs from the oil and gas spills. It's not true of the other industries. Now, that's a paraphrase, but it's darn close to her comment. So I think that given that this would be proof in a court of law as part of a civil action, and that it's true to really the inflationary rate, that it merits the committee's serious consideration. Any other comments? Okay. The objection was Representative Tallarico's. You maintain it?
Maintained.
So Ms. Tillinghast, if you'll call the roll on Amendment Number 2.
And
Representative Bratcher?
No.
Representative Tallarico?
No.
Representative Lincoln?
No.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Perry?
Yes.
Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Representative Joseph?
Yes. Okay. So that Amendment Number 2 fails, as did the previous amendment. So we now move to Amendment Number 3. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And because the amendments aren't numbered, I'm going to use the amendment number, and then if the following folks could do that, that might be helpful just to make sure folks are able to follow on. Along. So what I'm moving as Amendment Number 3 is 30-LS1015/0.16.
Okay. So moved. Representative Tarr, do you want to speak to your amendment?
Is there an objection to the amendment?
Is there an objection to the amendment?
Object.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will speak to this. Okay. So this one, I think if folks have the bill in front of them, it'll be helpful to look at the bill as we look at the amendment, because it's got changes in three parts that are all related. So just starting on page 7, line 28, so this is in the administrative penalties, and so this one is actually a reduction. So notice now, in the current bill draft, an administrative penalty assessed under this section may not be less than $1,000. So this would change it to 500, so that would reduce that in half, so that that first one, you know, could just be the $500 penalty. And then the next, delete the initial and insert each. So so may not be less than 500 nor more than 10,000 for each violation. So just looking at that part, how that goes together. So it reduces the dollar amount and then makes it for each violation. And this was in conversations with the department for two reasons. One, the $1,000 seemed like it could be a little bit too high for a small spill. And then also just the wording change there. Basically, and without getting too complicated here, but the second part of this amendment makes a change that is related to Section A, and so need to allow them to be able to assess each violation rather than just the initial, because if we don't make that change, there's a conflict between the words the initial in subsection B and then the words serious discharge or repeat discharges in subsection A. So this comes at the recommendation of the department. So the first part, probably easier to understand, just reducing from $1,000 to $500. But again, the second part is because if you look at Section A, so this would be end of line 24 going on to line 25, where it says permits a serious discharge or repeat discharges. So it's just making sure the language works for initial and repeat. And then looking at page 7, lines 28, 29, and may not exceed $24 a gallon of oil discharged. So this, again, is kind of related to the previous section, but basically in consultation with the department, came to our attention that the $24 a gallon is not necessary. The penalty is already capped at $10,000, which would be the equivalent to a spill of 417 gallons with the $24 cap. This section covers up to 18,000-gallon spills, so the $24 cap doesn't really work because of the sort of the volume problem there. And so, for example, the $24 cap also conflicts with the minimum penalty in the case of a smaller spill. So, for example, if someone spilled 15 gallons, the fine would be capped at $360 rather than the $500 minimum. So the department flagged this as a concern. So this kind of cleans it up, again, in conjunction with the other language changes and the reduction to $500. And then on page 8, line 6, Again, now, and this all has to kind of go together, and hopefully this is making some sense here. So what happens on page 8, line 6, is once the $24 per gallon cap is removed, with this, you know, the previous part of the amendment we looked at, nothing else in the section authorizes or requires the Department of Environmental Conservation to calculate the volume of the spill. And so amendment 3 now, with this insertion of volume extent, so basically what we're adding back in is the ability for them to calculate the volume and putting that in front of the word extent so that the Department of Environmental Conservation retains their ability to calculate the volume of the spill. So four changes in that one. The first, reducing the value in half. The second, third, and fourth all really related to each other. Because once you remove that $24 a gallon cap, then you need to make the language conform with that.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't like this bill, and one of the reasons I don't like it is because it's inconsistency. And one of the issues we discussed, it does relate to oil and crude oil. So when we're talking about assessing penalties against a person or persons that permit a serious discharge, in the case of the Bethel accidental oil spill at the school and 3,000 gallons, is it 24 gallons or $24 a gallon? Would that be leveled against the school district in Bethel for an accidental discharge? Or, I mean, how do we deal with that in a situation like that where they have an accidental discharge? No, I mean, nobody's really at fault. I mean, no, it wasn't done intentionally. How is that penalty administered?
Director Ryan, can you answer that for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, let me try to paraphrase though before I do. Representative Birch, are you asking what penalty could be applied toward the Bethel school that had the spill?
Yes.
Representative Birch, through the chair, if the bill was enacted, the criteria that are outlined in the bill would have to be considered to determine if a penalty was warranted. And there are several factors there that would need to be analyzed, you know, gross negligence, cause and harm to the environment, what was left that they were not able to contain. So it's difficult. I can't tell you the amount because that's what all need to be evaluated. But technically, yes, it's a 3,000-gallon spill, so we could use, as the bill is written, administrative penalty authority to evaluate the potential for a penalty.
A follow-up, Representative Birch.
So basically it's a subjective determination, not so much as to what the adverse impact of the spill actually is or what it costs to clean up, but whether or not the person that's doing the regulating decides they want to level the penalty, the administrative penalty, or not. So it's basically a subjective decision that way?
Representative Birch, through the chair, I wouldn't call it subjective. I mean, that's the point of the legislation, is to clarify what specific standards you as a legislator would want us to apply to make that determination. That specific section of the bill requires it only to be utilized as written for serious or repeat violations. This is not a repeat violation, so we already haven't crossed that line, and I'd have to evaluate it to determine if it was serious. But we look to guidance from the legislature so that we don't make subjective decisions.
Follow up?
Yeah, it says serious discharge or repeat discharge, and I guess serious is always in the eye of the beholder. You know, one person's... I think the teaspoon that we had to report when I was at Alyeska Pipeline versus, 3,000. I mean, it's a very, it's kind of subjective to, or depends on the situation you're in, but I do have some concerns about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Let me just follow up just on this topic with some questions. Director Ryan, you told us that in the instance of the Hillcorp gas leaks, the department could have issued essentially penalties or sought them through the court, but it declined to. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, the Hillcorp release, so there are two incidents, the natural gas release and then the oil release. The natural gas release was not, there was not a volume calculated, which Representative Tarr pointed out in when we provided statistics on spill amounts. There, we did not calculate a liquid volume amount of that natural gas release. And didn't include it in our spill volumes that we received last year, that the environment received. So that would need to occur first, I guess, is some sort of process to decide what would be the volume of that release from a liquid perspective, because that drives which penalty would be utilized, mm-hmm. You know, depending on how large the volume was.
Okay. And as to the oil?
The oil, Mr. Chairman, was difficult to quantify, but I believe we settled on, was it 3 gallons? It was quite small.
Okay.
So our existing penalty authority in our statutes would require going to court to pursue a penalty for 3 gallons. It would be pretty impossible, I would say, to prove there was a significant impact to the environment from a 3 gallon release.
Right.
So that was why penalties were not pursued there.
And just one other question, and I'm not going to hog the mic here, but if someone received an administrative penalty, they would be able to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings and appeal it?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The way the bill's written, as is our existing administrative penalty authority elsewhere in the department, they are appealable decisions. They just are appealed to the administrative law judge rather than going through our judicial system.
And lastly, if you took them to court, they could offset or subtract the amount of the penalty from the court judgment.
Mr. Chairman, as the bill is written, correct. Any administrative penalty levied would be considered and subtracted from any a civil penalty assessed by a court.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, and I'm not very good with legal language, but in line 24 of page 7, and we are talking about crude oil in this section, if I'm not wrong, it says a penalty against a person. So I'm just trying to figure out what they mean by that. What is a person? Is if I have a job and I work for, you know, XYZ Drilling, or I work for XYZ Oil Services, and I create a small spill by, I don't know, not closing a valve all the way and looking the other way for a few minutes or whatever, a person, am I that person? And is that penalty going to be assessed against me?
Director Ryan, I mean, I have some thoughts. There are a number of bills that confront the same circumstance. We have one in Labor and Commerce now. But Director Ryan, what is your belief on that? Or do we need to call the attorney?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rauscher, I would defer to Department of Law on the definition of person. It exists in statute in many places for us. I think it's sort of a legal term of art. But I really would have to defer to Department of Law.
Okay. We can do that.
Through the chair?
Yes.
While they,
Representative
if
Ralph.
They would like to round that person up, I can wait for that answer if you want while I have another question.
Please. Why don't you proceed with your other question?
Well, I get worried about, through the chair, I get worried about penalties. When you start talking about taking away $24 a gallon oil discharge or language, where it's almost to the point where right now we have on the North Slope, having worked up there, I see that people will turn in very small amounts of oil discharge. Well, I think you might be tending people not to want to do that here after a while when you start these penalties getting to be too severe for too small amounts. I think right now it's working. I may be wrong, but I see that as I see them reporting things because they're concerned about their environment. I don't want to get them in a mood where they want to, you know, worry about being held too far liable for stuff they even clean up. Even if they clean it up, they report it. I'm really not sure where we're headed with this, but I think it's kind of a dangerous area. Going from where we are, which is actually being environment-friendly, to I don't know if I should report this now.
Well, just let me make a couple of comments. Number one, under the law right now, Representative Rauscher, they have to report.
Right.
So we're not changing that law. Secondly, the fiscal note suggests the increase will be $75,000. Mm-hmm. And as Kara Moriarty said, 2% of this is sort of North Slope concerned, mostly, because mm-hmm. it's mostly an oil and gas industry. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to tell you except that if we don't update the law, we're stuck in 1977 forever, and the cost of cleanup exceeds the amount that the SPAR takes in, and so the industry is covering more than its share, and the people of the state are paying for it through a general fund. And that's an option. We can continue to do that. But those are my thoughts. Any other questions about... Yes.
Follow up?
Please.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, you know, we did ask for some numbers on the sizes and whether or not they were cleaned up and all that information, which we haven't gotten yet. So I'm just saying that we haven't really gotten some of the information we've asked for on these types of spills and everything. Well, at least I haven't. I don't know. Maybe you all have and I haven't.
Did you receive the document, the lengthy document, dated February 7th, 5 days ago, that we posted on BASIS, that answers just about every question I could imagine of the number of crude oil spills, the number of non-crude oil spills, which industry did what the costs are, what we paid to go to court to enforce
I'm
them.
Sorry, I didn't see it. I apologize.
Okay. I believe the staff posted this on BASIS and probably noticed it. We also have the attorney from up the hill who has helped craft this. That's her job to help us with that. Her name is Emily Naumann. She's going to call in, and she's going to tell us, I believe, that a person is defined under, for purposes of this law, under AS 4604-917. And this bill doesn't change that. So... It just doesn't change that, but it says a person means an individual, public or private corporation, political subdivision, government agency, municipality, industry, partnership, association, firm, trust, estate, or any other entity. So I think that pretty well answers that. It's certainly in the same title. But we can confirm that that's applicable to, Ms. Naumann?
Yes, I'm here.
It's Andy Josephson. We have a question from Representative Rauscher who asks about the person who might be subject to a penalty on page 7, line 24. And I'm told that you would assert that 4604-900's definition at subsection 17 would be applicable.
For the record, this is Emily Naumann. I'm with Legislative Legal. Representative Josephson, the text of the definition that you read is correct. The citation is actually 4603-918 because this is in title of chapter 4603, not 4604. But your definition is absolutely correct, that would be who the person referred to on page 7 would be.
Okay. And just for the record, it makes sense that it would be in 4603 because we're talking about 4603. And what you see there, I was told it might be 4604, but what you see there is the same definition, essentially. So
correct.
So Representative Rauscher, the answer to your question is that the word person is fully defined in the code right now. And if I look here, there have been many amendments to these definitions spanning from 1971 to 2015. So I can't know when that word was defined in that part of the code, but it's there. Any other questions about amendment?
Sure, I appreciate your
sure.
Any other questions on that? Thank you.
About amendment number 3? Representative Lincoln, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that we did get some responses from the department on questions we had, but there are other questions that weren't answered. Like, you know, I wanted to see the math and some of the backup documentation on the $75,000 figure. Just getting an answer without some background on it wasn't as helpful as it could have been.
And I appreciate that. And my staff can assure you that I did everything in my power relative to that. I would say that in their memo, the memo that I noted answers, it's a 6-page single-space memo on just about every topic we've discussed in great depth. It was posted for the members, and in it, it talks about the derivation of the $75,000 figure. Perhaps not in the detail that the vice chair sought, in all fairness, but it talks about it at page 3.
Mm-hmm. Page.
And any other questions about amendment number 3? Okay, I don't see any other questions. There was an objection. I don't recall the maker of the objection. Is the objection maintained?
Can you take a brief at ease?
Yes, at ease.
Thank you.
Back on record at 1:40, and I think Representative Lincoln, actually Representative Johnson, I don't recall where we were, frankly. Are there any questions about Amendment 3?
I think we're done for me. I think Rep. Johnson had the objection.
So would you like to maintain your objection, Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Okay. So there's an objection, and we've had our discussion, and so I turn to Ms. Tillinghast, will you take the roll?
No.
Representative Rauscher.
No.
Representative Tallarico.
No.
Representative Lincoln.
Yes.
Representative Drummond.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Birch.
No.
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Joseph.
Yes. All right, that takes us to Amendment number 4. Yes, sorry. For the record, Amendment 3 passed by a vote of 5-4. And so we move to Amendment number 4, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to testimony that we received last week from...
Can you move your amendment?
Excuse me, I so move.
Okay.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to testimony we received last week from the Alaska Trucking Association and others, a significant portion of this proposal is unnecessary, burdensome, and duplicative. In fact, the federal program relating to contingency programs is already included under 49 CFR Part 130, which prescribes contingency plans for the transport of oil. So I think this amendment proposes to basically reduce that duplicative component of the bill in response to that recognition. We don't need to be layering up the requirements on our industry in Alaska. There's already a CFR or a CFR requirement for that contingency plan, and that availability was discussed in committee. I think it was news, or at least by my sense, it was news to the our friends in the Department of Environmental Conservation that was actually available to them. So, in light of that, I've offered this amendment to reduce the burdensome and duplicative effort that this would require. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments about Amendment 4 from Representative Birch? Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just going to repeat this. Amendment number 4 is 30-LS1015/0.10. Just so we're clear on that, because actually the next amendment is fairly similar, and so that's what's going to prevent me from supporting this amendment, although I just wanted to speak to this one to say to Representative Birch that, you know, I felt like I heard that same testimony and that there's not a need to have them do something that is just duplicative in nature. And so what I felt like I also heard was the department say they would like to just have access to those, and that seemed like a good safety planning feature. And so I'm going to hold support on Amendment number 4, but we'll be supporting the next amendment because it will accomplish what you're suggesting, Representative Birch, and help with that and not giving them more work to do, but will also accomplish getting the department access to that important safety information.
And I will save my comments as chair for the end unless this is the right moment. Are there other comments? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Between the current language of the bill and this amendment, I see the subsequent amendment as an intermediate option. And thus, I find it unfortunate that we should be offering them with the most extreme of the remedies first. However, that being what it is, I think it's best to have an explicit requirement of cooperation between the companies transporting crude oil in the state of Alaska and the Department of Environmental Conservation, with which they'll need to be coordinating during cleanup. I think that this amendment goes a little bit too far by not requiring any such cooperation.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. And I'll just take this opportunity to comment on something. While not before us, it is relevant, and it's the amendment that follows. It cites 4604, and in 4604 we see that there are contingency plans that are produced right now, today, February 12th, 2018, for oil terminal facilities, pipelines, and tank vessels. So there are contingency plans and prevention plans that the law, not this bill, the existing law, requires the state get to see. For reasons that are not totally clear to me, the state doesn't at first blush, unless it exercises some real effort, get to see plans that are already extant, that is, that have already been written and are out there. I would remind the members that in the hearing last Friday, and I have the moments in the meeting when it was said, Mr. Thompson, and I want to be fair to him, and you'll hear this fairness, I hope. Mr. Thompson said 17 minutes into the meeting, it wouldn't be too much of an objection to sharing the plans. Now, the fairness is, he said, I'd really like to talk to my members, but that's one time where he said, sharing the plans sounds okay. Then 19 minutes into the meeting, he said, sharing the plans is fine. Then Representative Parrish asked him again, and you, Mr. Representative Parrish used the word burdensome. Is it burdensome? And 30 minutes into the meeting, Mr. Thompson said, it's not terribly difficult. So three times he said, we can do this. And so since they're willing to do it and the state doesn't know much about these response plans, and that's the term DOT Federal uses, I'm going to be opposing the amendment. Any other comments about the amendment? Okay. There was an objection from Representative Tarr, I believe.
I'll maintain my objection so that she can call the roll.
All right. So, Ms. Pillinghast, as to Amendment 4, will you take the roll?
Yes. Representative Birch.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
Yes.
Representative Tallarico?
Yes.
Representative Lincoln?
No.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Parrish?
No.
Representative Tarr?
No.
Representative Joseph?
No. So amendment number 4 fails, and we move to amendment number 5, Representative Parrish.
I move amendment number 5, that is 30-LS1015/0.17.
Is there an objection to the motion to move amendment 5?
Object.
There's an objection. Representative Birch, would you like to talk to your objection?
Trying to read through and understand it. I'm concerned, as I mentioned in the last round, is I'm concerned about the duplicative nature of our, kind of our regulatory environment that we operate in. The CFRs currently require any oil, as I understand it, and as we have heard from testimony parsed out by yourself last week, that there is a, you know, basically a federal CFR requirement for contingency plans. And I'm just concerned that we may be duplicating that effort. Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really appreciate those comments, Representative Birch, and felt like that's what you know, that conversation with Mr. Thompson really tried to unravel and really understand. The part that gives me comfort here is on lines 11, 12, and 13 of this amendment, page 1, basically it says, you know, they can't operate unless the person has submitted to the department and the department has received the oil spill response plan. So one of the things we talked a lot about was whether the department should have a way to weigh in or have some approval mechanism. I was leaning towards that because I think, you know, they're competent individuals who are really, you know, the ones who are responding on a daily basis and might be able to identify, you know, an issue or something prior to a problem happening. But what we heard in the testimony was that, you know, there was some, you know, definitely some concern about what that meant in terms of two approval processes and things like that. So didn't feel like we were ready to go to that step today. But again, with this one, you know, what we're saying is just, you know, take the information you're already preparing for the federal regulators and just, they're just saying they just need to receive it and have a copy of it on file. And I think that, you know, hopefully should there be any incident, that would just help us to be that much more prepared or be able to respond that much more quickly and contain, you know, any spill and limit the environmental impact to human health. So, you know, I think it is important for us to consider things like that in terms of duplicative, you know, requirements. But because this one is just saying to share it with us and additionally not, you know, even giving them that step of approval or participation in the process, I think we've made it as, you know, we've limited any burden that they might experience from that requirement. So that makes me feel comfortable supporting it.
Representative Parrish and then Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment has a very narrow focus. It's only pertains to commercial motor vehicles transporting crude on a highway or road maintained by the state. So, first of all, very narrow focus. It asks that the companies which do that, I believe you said there are two in the state, submit the contingency plans, the oil spill response plans, which they're already preparing for the federal government. It asks that they provide those to the state of Alaska, and that's something that can be done with a fax machine or something that I do with my cell phone and email. As the chair's already pointed out, the executive director of the truckers had said that it would not be a considerable burden. However, it would allow us to displace labor from some of our overworked DEC people. Right now, they could go down to the various offices, the dispatching center, the place of business, and request those C plans, the contingency plans, and they would be provided them. It's believed. It's not known whether this has ever happened before. This just saves us some shoe leather, and in these days that's in precious short supply. It also stipulates that people who have a C plan should follow it, or at least follow up with at least comparable resources to those that they've outlined. In terms of duplicating review, at present, these plans are not subject to federal review. They're kept, well, they're not, as a general practice, reviewed at all. They're kept in a file folder in someone's place of business. And that's not, from where I'm standing, adequate oversight. I'm a big believer in trusting, but verifying. And right now, the state of Alaska is stopping at trust.
Before we get to Representative Birch, you're welcome to sort of close out the amendment. And I apologize if I haven't been
it's
doing
my
this.
Amendment.
Sorry. My apologies.
I appreciate the comments by Co-Chair Tarr, and with the clarification that it is not yet another hurdle to cross, but in reviewing and with that assurance, I will withdraw my objection.
Thanks, sir. Okay. Any other objection to Amendment 5? Representative Tallarico, you object?
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to object.
You want to speak to your...
I will, Mr. Chair, and I'll probably withdraw my objection, but I kind of want to draw attention to some very awkward language in this amendment on line 20, page 1. Although, and you know how we are about semantics, but mm-hmm. we have... I'll start on line 18, if I could, Mr. Chair, and read this.
Absolutely.
If the holder of a response plan submitted to the department under this section fails to respond to and conduct a cleanup operations of an unpermitted discharge of crude oil with the quality and quantity. I won't go on, but I wish there was better language there, because quite honestly, when the general public reads that, I think they may ask, where do you get a permit for the discharge of crude oil? To me, it may just be me, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your patience with me. That seems a tad cumbersome and not really, if you read it several times, which I did, it seems to be a little maybe not as clear as it could be with different language. Mr. Chairman, I don't have a suggestion for other language, but with that, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point that out because that seemed that it didn't flow, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and I'll remove my objection as well.
Right. Any other objections to Amendment 5? I don't see any, and so Amendment 5 is adopted. And that takes us to the bill itself with two amendments having been adopted, Amendments 3 and Amendment 5. So at this point, we're at discussion. And I'm going to keep a tally of who requests comment first. Any takers? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity. Mr. Chairman, I'm still struggling with the idea that, and like I say, it may just be my perspective on that, but what we've heard about in these spills is usually the value-added products. The crude oil is part of it, but some of the other things are definitely value-added products that we've discussed and everything. And we do have a process in place. I do think it works. I would agree with the representative from Sutton that I do have a concern that as we add to this, we make it more cumbersome. Right now, I think we've got great reporting going on for people that do these spills and everything, and I have the same concern that he does. I don't think people would intentionally do that, but if they feel the program's too cumbersome, they may want to overlook a few of these things. I seriously doubt that anyone would intentionally do that, but as we add to this and we make this a little more cumbersome for people and we add to the expense, there's a tremendous amount of expense, as we've heard in some of these, for the actual cleanup for the companies that are involved. They really do get out there. You know, we talk about as we move these things around and out in some areas of the district that I represent, I got to tell you, every drop of any of these products is precious. Nobody wants to spill anything, for sure, and they do their best not to do that. So For those reasons, Mr. Chair, I won't be supporting the bill, but I thank you for the opportunity to speak to it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Anyone else like to talk? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I've objected this. I object to this being a committee bill because I didn't really care to be on as a co-signer, if you will, through the committee process. I object to the muddled nature of this. I mean, we have in a section here, sir, on section 10, where we talk about economic savings and a competitive advantage gained by non-compliance with the standard. There's no discussion as to quantity of gallons, how large the penalty might be, what the valuation might be. This whole bill is replete with confusing and contradictory concerns. You know, we tried to address some of them in the amendment process, but I think it's a solution in search of a problem. We've seen testimony and had testimony about the incredible good work that's going on. The crude oil that this is intended to be focused on is less than 2% of the spills, and even at that, we've had a steady decline in the frequency, the volume, and every other aspect of good management that we would expect. We already talked about how it's duplicative in nature. I think from the standpoint of just trying to do business, I think when we start layering up the additional regulatory components with this and anything else, it just starts, it adds to costs and reduces our competitive advantage in Alaska and what we would hope to have in attracting investment and doing resource development. So I am a no vote on this. I think we've discussed some of the aspects that we have. We're going to have some problems with the unintended consequences. We had testimony last week on a somewhat related bill from a homeowner who had a personal oil spill and was looking to waive the costs associated with contacting DEC. So we've got a kind of a system here where we need to focus on, and we're apparently doing a good job of that because with the frequency and the volume of spills has declined. I think this is a solution in search of a problem, and I will be a no vote. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other comments from members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I will be voting against this bill, and for mainly, well, there's a number of reasons, but we had industry testimony here to talk to us about an increase in oil taxes. And during that time that we had representatives, multiple representatives from maybe not every oil company represented in Alaska, doing business in Alaska, but during that time, that's when this bill was dropped in committee as a committee bill, which I object to as well. And it was, I think, maybe disappointing theatrics to get everybody in the room and introduce this bill.
Representative Johnson, I think that's inappropriate. I'm really not that offended.
I'll retract. It seemed theatrical. I don't know that it was, but it seemed that way. So, but anyway, everyone was in the room, and I guess it just adds to the uncertainty of having ongoing changes to our industry regulations, whether it's actually the taxes or transportation. So, and I've said this, maybe if we were looking at a rewrite of spills and cleanup, if we were taking that on independently, there might be things in this bill that could be examined and maybe the right thing. Not necessarily all of it, but the way that we're going about this, I just have to object to it. I mean, it doesn't stand alone, and I would say it would stand alone if it wasn't for the fact that it was introduced in conjunction at the time when we had invited testimony in the room. So anyway, just in as a general piece where we're not here just to change regulations, change taxes, and it feels randomly, I will not be supporting this bill in interest of stability and showing that we are for a stable environment in our number one resource extraction and major portion of our budget.
Well, I think I'll take the opportunity to just to respond just a little bit while it's fresh in my mind. There's an argument, and for the record and for the members of the audience, we introduced a what's called a committee bill. The Alaska law allows for committee bills. So we followed the law, and some members are unhappy about that. I think the record would reflect that in the 30th legislature, which we're in, the House has used the committee bill opportunity less than in the 28th and 29th legislature. That's point number one. Point number two, there was comment about members who were invited. They weren't invited relative to the committee bill, but they were from the oil and gas industry and heard the motion for the committee bill. One might argue that that means it was fully transparent, that at the birth of the committee bill, they heard it. Now, was that intentional? No, and I'll tell you why. This bill is being heard today at the same time where Native Alaskans are here from the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association to talk about spills on Native land. Now, did we schedule that because we happen to have a spill bill today? No. They're in town, and they asked for the time, and we gave them the time. So sometimes things seem uncanny and therefore planned, but sometimes they're not. They're just happenstances. And then just briefly on Representative Birch's comment, you talked about how great the oil industry is doing. I agree. And I think Ms. Moriarty makes that case. I have concerns about corrosion issues, and I have, a right to have that concern. BP paid us hundreds of millions of dollars over that. But I agree that the oil and gas record is a good one, and there's evidence of it. But Ms. Moriarty agrees with me that other industries are not, she didn't point anyone in particular, but she said they are not complying with the cleanup costs the way the oil and gas industry is. So I just wanted to make those comments. Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I share a lot of the concerns with this bill that have already been expressed. I will support it moving out of committee so that I can get further work in other committees and perhaps the Senate side if it gets that far. But I think it was improved today, and I appreciate all the work that everyone in the committee has put into it so far. I wish we had more time to further improve it.
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Rauscher, then Drummond. Go ahead. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the history that we were given in regards to the reason for this bill and the fact that there are commercial trucks transporting crude oil that has not been regulated or watched the way spills from oil drilling facilities and oil transport, oil tank facilities. I think it's very important to pass this bill for that reason, to cover a new section of industry that I'm quite aware of the number of spills that have happened, and I would like to see that control happen. In addition, the last amendment that passed eliminated 5 pages of this bill and replaced it with just barely over 1 and contributed considerably to the clarity of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the intent of what you're trying to do to cover costs for the state. I think this bill does a lot more than that. I believe it puts a certain amount of limitations on companies, which I'm not even sure are realistic with the hours and the timetables. I think that I've stated before that a lot of what's going on in the industry is being addressed very well. They're concerned about their environment. They've shown that when statistics are going down, when the spills are going down, when the volumes of that type are going down, and I think that has something to say for the industry itself and how they recognize what the environment means to the state and what it means to them. So I'm not sure that this bill is actually going to do what it's intended to do. I'm not sure just that you're going to raise the funding that you're thinking, but I also think that it's going to make somewhat of a deterrent and some impossibilities for people to attain. And under those circumstances, I will probably have to be a no on this one, but I do appreciate where you're trying to go with it.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking through the bill again just to make sure that I hadn't missed anything. You know, really, if we think back to the presentation by the department, what they've said is that it's not about how many spills are happening today. It's not really even about the volume of spills that are happening today. It's that if you compare 1977 or 1989 dollar amounts with today, you know, even under a reduced number of spills and reduced volume, you know, the fines and penalties that they're able to assess just do not recoup the cost for the circumstances where the operator was not able to pay for the cost of cleanup themselves. And so, you know, I was just looking as a, you know, sort of metric, a gallon of gas was 63 cents in 1977 and, you know, averages about $2.80 now. I mean, that's the same reason why we need to pass this bill. And I hope that we'll continue to see those trends in, you know, fewer spills and smaller volumes. I mean, that's certainly the hope that we have here. But I think we have to recognize that, you know, that dollar amount is just not the same it doesn't have the same buying power that it had when it was enacted. And so, for example, you know, when we look at page 2, you know, the following schedule of fixed penalties for discharges of oil, you know, $20 per gallon for a gallon of oil that goes into an anadromous stream. I mean, we know it would be much more than $20 to clean that up if the, you know, responsible party does not engage in a cleanup in the way they're supposed to, and then the state has to take on that responsibility. So, unfortunately, the state is in the position to be the entity that cleans things up sometimes, and I think, you know, given the importance of our, you know, subsistence fishing and commercial fishing, sport fishing, I just want to make sure that they have the resources to be able to do that. And I think we've, you know, actually the legislature has given them direction that says they have to be able to recoup as much of their costs as possible, and this is, you know, this is a step towards accomplishing the very directive that the legislature gave them. So I'll be supporting the bill today.
Thank you. Any other comments from members? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that we're going up to half the value suggested by inflation on the majority of these. That's a step in the right direction. I don't think that we should allow penalties to be eroded to a quarter of their previous values without some concern, without some trepidation. I think that it's good that we're moving beyond just trusting and verifying for contingency plans. I'm reading a response from the department here talking about the effect of crude oil and other refined fuels. Crude oil concentrations at several critical points in a salmon's life cycle can have negative impacts as small as 1 nanogram per liter. That's one part per trillion. They can have adverse effects. And those costs are hard to quantify. I guess you'd have to ask the people who depend on those salmon to survive what their worth is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments or desire to comment, I would ask my co-chair for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 322, Work Order 30-LS1015/O, as amended, with any fiscal notes from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there an objection to the motion?
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
There's an objection, so I'm wondering, do I get to let you speak to the objection, or we sort of did that, didn't we?
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer that we go ahead and move forward and
fair enough.
Not have any more discussion. I think we've discussed it.
Ms. Tillinghast.
Representative Drummond.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Burke.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Rauscher.
No.
Representative Talarico.
No.
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes. All right, so at this time, we're going to take a brief at ease and sign the paperwork.
Okay.
All right, prior to that, at ease, the committee advanced House Bill 322 by a vote of 5-4 and completed the paperwork reflecting our recommendations on that bill. So now at 2:16, the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association is before the committee, and I would invite whomever is going to present the slideshow, who must know the most about the topic of the slideshow,
we'll see.
To come before us.
I might have to phone a friend.
Okay. And if you'll, sorry, Ms. Bissett. Do you say Bissett or?
Bissett.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. And if you'll put your name on the record.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my voice is almost gone.
Do you need
my name is Holly Bissett.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, we're going to get through this at the right octave.
Well, let's let the mic be our friend.
Yeah. Thank you for your time today, Mr. Chair, and the co-chair, Tara, for setting it up. We're very excited to be here today talking to you about something very important to our organization, the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. Oh, my goodness. So, of course.
Ms. Bissett, I sometimes feel like I'm trying to be a hero, and if you don't want to play the hero role and you want to get some, phone a friend or tag someone, you're certainly welcome to do that.
Yeah, my chairman will come sit with me and jump in if he needs to. Cut the crud on the plane. So we were created in 2008, about 10 years ago, by founding member of the Kuskokwim Corporation, TKC. We consist of both full paid. I can't talk at all. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Sir, if you'll give us your name, you can proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan McCowan. I'm the chair of the board of the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. I'm also president and CEO of C. George Tana Corporation, one of the member entities. The ANVCA has 176 members in it. All of the remaining village corporations that were formed pursuant to ANCSA, there were over 220 originally. Some of those merged together and others merged with their appropriate regional corporation. We have a 9-member board of directors. You have to be the president, CEO, or chair in order to be eligible to serve. I'm the CEO of my village corporation. I've been serving on the board for about 4 years now, and 2 years as the chair. We also have partner organizations, non-member entities who are interested in being affiliated with us because of the mission and the people and organizations to whom we serve. So the
pardon me. Could you just go back to the
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second bullet on the previous slide where it's, okay, consists of full paid and affiliate level Alaska Native Village Corporations created our ANCSA, 176 left. Could you give that data point again of how many?
So there were 220 that were created pursuant to ANCSA. In the early 1980s, late 1970s, first, there was an amendment to ANCSA that passed in the late 70s that allowed for the mergers of corporations. They realized that there was a lot of capacity issues with that many villages across the state trying to do something that had never been done before, individuals overseeing for-profit entities. And so you had a wave of consolidation that occurred that's brought the 220 number down to 176. For instance, in the Northwest Arctic region, all but one village merged with its regional corporation. In the Otna region, all but one village merged with its corporation. The Kuskokwim Corporation, who was the founding member of ANVCA, is actually 10 villages, corporations that merged together. So.
And
sorry.
I follow up?
Jeez, follow up. Representative Tarr.
Coughing co-chair, coughing presenters. We're all good here. So with that, that means that everybody, you know, all of the remaining ones are participating as members of your organization.
That, is that right? Okay. That is correct, Madam Co-Chair.
All right, continue.
So the mission of the organization, the organization was originally created in order to be a receptacle for the various CEOs to get together and share best practices, and has blossomed over time to really be the primary advocate in order to ensure the success of the village corporations. We have a pretty substantial spectrum of how village corporations are doing. Some very large notable ones, and then we have many, many who are on the opposite end, struggling, trying to figure out how to stay in business. So the vision that we have of the organization is to be both to educate the village corporations and share best practices, but also to advocate for them in ways that they are not able to advocate as individuals. We spend a lot of time trying to reach out to them, no matter where they are in the state, given the wide geographic disparities, and really a focus on the sustainability, making sure that these entities last over the long term. So when you hear about the village corporations, oftentimes people mistake the urban and regional corporations with each other. People go into Midtown Anchorage and they see all the big buildings and they think that's what the ANCs are. We have some very large notable village corporations among our membership: Ukpiagwek, Nupiak Corporation, Barrow, Chiniga, Afognak, but we also have many, many that are small and whose names would not be familiar to anyone. So from the slide, you see 19% of the revenue on the top 49ers comes from the Alaska Native village corporations. When you put the regionals in the mix, it's 73%. So we constitute, even in ourselves, a very large portion of the Alaskan economy.
Those are just the ones that report.
Yeah, we as you know, under the regulations, if you don't have 500 shareholders, you're not required to report. And so there's a lot of underreporting that happens amongst the economic activity of the village corporations. So this is just a brief list of our directors. As you see, we have quite a bit of spread. We have representation for most of the 12 regions of the state. What do we do as an organization? We have networking events. We have what we call fishnet lunches, where we invite individuals both from the public sector as well as the private sector to come and talk about relevant topics to us. You know, we've had discussions on various pieces of legislation. We've had discussions on new burgeoning industries, government contracting, various things. And then we have an annual conference meeting where we get together and we really hash out things that may be important to us. Okay. So what are we working on right now? Primarily, we've been working on two things on the state level. We've been working on the ANCSA land solution. So when ANCSA conveyed 44 million acres of entitled lands, or I should say the ANCSA created 44 million acres of entitlement, and when the conveyances started to occur throughout the 1970s, the federal government Bureau of Land Management was not required at that point in time to disclose whether or not there had been existing contamination. This problem started being noticed in the 1980s as more and more villages became aware of the inventory of what was on their lands. And began to realize that it was not limited to a certain number of a region or a certain number of sites. There was a report that BLM had put together in the 1990s that noted there were 635 sites at that point in time where there was pre-existing contamination that is not caused by the relevant village or regional entity. And so what we've been doing over the span of time in the last 10 years has been trying to educate people about what the issue is and slowly work through the process both on the state and federal level in order to achieve a lasting and long-term solution. Now, the solutions are probably going to be a mixture. You know, it could be, you know, from just identifying the cleanup and accessing the funds that are involved for remediation, all the way through the potential for land trades. We know this is a longitudinal issue. It's not going to happen overnight, so we're chipping away at it as time by time it goes.
So he just went through this whole timeline, so we're going to skip over.
So the report, so where we're at right now on the federal level is the BLM has updated the report that they pushed in 1998 to 2016. They've said that 537 sites now require remediation. What the challenge that we're showing is that even though that all these sites have been identified, Congress has not actually authorized or appropriated any money to take care of this issue. We feel that there's a gross underreporting just because of the nature of where these sites are and the strict liability that's associated with them. And so we're trying to ensure that first, number one, we can figure out how big is the problem ultimately. Is it 1,000 sites? Is it 1,500 sites? No one really knows. And then we can start figuring out a way or several ways of combating it depending upon the nature of the sites and where they're located. So where we're going next, we've created a strategic task force, EPA, Department of Interior, and DEC. Have joined to form cooperating agencies. We're continuing to work in Washington, D.C. and here in the Capitol. We've been developing criteria to prioritize the sites, most especially the sites that are closest to human habitation. We have a number of different entities that are known to have potential contamination that could affect groundwater, as well as subsistence lands in and around some of our villages.
Yes, Representative Tarr, do you have a question for Mr. McGowan?
Yeah, I just want to go back, and I'm sorry because I'm just trying to follow along and make sure I get this. If we can go back a couple of slides. So this new report came out. This new report comes out in 2016,
mm-hmm.
The number has gone from 650 to 537. So there's some progress.
Allegedly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, so, you know, hopefully in some places at least some progress. But, you know, what I was understanding under the previous slide is that the 1998 report said, you know, had to establish a forum of inks for landholders, you know, and do all these things. So now you've got a 2016 report. There's some fewer sites possibly, mm-hmm. but in terms of the 1998 report recommendations, all of that infrastructure that was recommended, does that exist, or has that forum ever been established or any of that?
So just to understand the stocks and flows of what we're talking about here, the 1998 report identified 650 sites. There were some that got cleaned up in the interim, but we still believe that either if it's 1998 or 2016, there's a substantial disincentive amongst village corporations to hold your hands up and announce that you actually have a dirty site because of the strict liability. So we believe that there's a substantial underreporting. So even I don't want to cast too rosy of a picture. Yes, it's good that the site number has reduced, but it could still be off by a factor of two or three from what it is in the reality. Mm-hmm. And so these were just the sites that were identified 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and they've only been reduced by, you know, 15%.
Follow up, Representative Tarr.
And so in this part where it says, you know, the BLM is not taking action on much of its 1998 report recommendations. So these report recommendations on that previous slide that involve these six,
right,
you know, bullets, this is the stuff that, in addition to not cleaning up sites, this stuff hasn't happened either. So that, or that, you see what I'm trying to, so I'm trying to understand, you know, has some of this infrastructure at least been put in place as recommended under this? So, you know, does a forum, I'm not sure exactly what that's supposed to mean. Does that exist, or if you could give a little update on the piece where it's saying, you know, didn't implement the other 1998 recommendations. If it's those things, could you just talk a little bit about these six items and where they're at?
Sure. Through the chair, the pieces and parts of all of these six were attempted, but none of them were fulfilled according to what the recommendations of the 1998 report were. You look at number two, compile a coordinated comprehensive inventory of contaminated sites with input from all parties. We're nowhere near that even today.
Wow.
And that's because of the disincentives that are there for village corporations to hold their hands up and say that they have a contaminated site because of the strict liability that accords to them. Okay. So pieces and parts of all of these have been done, but they're not. You can't actually go by a checklist and say, check, we got that one done.
Got it.
Mr. McGowan, just to follow up on that, is there no exemption for the village corporations on the strict liability based on the history and context? So their concerns are that they'll be tagged, and in a game of tag, they'll hold the responsibility. I mean, they could probably, I think in the law it's called subrogate or indemnify, and say, if me, then him. But nonetheless, they might bear some burden or complication. Is that
correct, Mr. Chair? As it stands right now, there is no way for us to abrogate the responsibility back to the federal government. There's no mechanism under the law, and that's one of the things that we're going to be seeking on the federal level to do so. DEC in the past has been very cooperative and recognizing the special nature and caliber of these lands, and has been willing to grant a certain number of waivers, but that's only as good as whatever the administration and whatever the administrative regime is. If there was DEC, commissioner that wanted to really go after us or go after the individuals who have the lands, they would be in a tough position because they do have the strict liability to clean this up, and many of them do not have the financial resources to even begin to approach the problem.
Representative Birch has a question. Go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. First of all, great to have you here today. Thank you very much. Very topical and on point. I guess one of the questions I have, can you give the land back through the chair? I mean, if it's really, I think I'll take a pass on this 160 or this chunk of acreage, and I'll pick this acreage over here. And I just don't know how much flexibility you have, or are you actually stuck with it? And I'd like to hear your insight on that.
Yeah, through the chair, there's not going to be a one-size-all-fit solution. As of right now, there is no mechanism for us to call a mulligan, as it were, and to select another site. But that would be amongst the solution options that we would like to be able to seek. Is if there is, either an economically disadvantageous remediation option. There's some sites in the villages where the pollution has gone down so far into the bedrock and into the substrate that it's prohibitively expensive for anybody to clean up, and could be characterized as a Superfund site at some point. And we would be wanting to have a toolbox of different solutions to be able to possibly do land exchanges, but also if it is reasonably economic to be able to clean it up, to be able to have the appropriations to do so.
Follow up,
President Birch.
I very much appreciate seeing among your 2018 state priorities the support for the Stand for Alaska initiative. I think you guys are where the rubber hits the road here, and I really appreciate that engagement and look forward to learning more. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. I think Representative Parrish had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. How much would it cost to substantively clean up the sites that can be cleaned up? Do you have any sense of the ballpark?
No.
Hundreds of millions?
Easily hundreds of millions. So just to give you an example, my own corporation on St. George Island had contamination from our time when the islands were under the SEAL service, later incorporated into NOAA. We had a number of relatively simple cleanups due to oil spills where the soil had to be essentially baked and all of the contaminants driven out of it. And that was $15 million, and that took care of maybe about 3 to 4 acres. You're talking about thousands of acres in as remote of locations as St. George, or even more remote, and the contaminants are of a different caliber and a different class than the simple petroleum that we encountered. So, you know, if you're ballparking it, I'd start with nine zeros and start working up.
Follow up, President Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that dire picture. What proportion of the sites do you feel represent an ongoing burden to the health of the neighboring communities, to the local, and then how much to the local ecology, and how many, if any, are relatively innocuous in their immediate impact? I guess the question is, how much is has got to get fixed, and how much can be sort of fenced off and left to be, and maybe traded out through a land swap.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't have an exact answer for you on that. We haven't analyzed the data that closely and tried to cut it up, but we'll work on that. But just to have an intuition about it, remember that the Village Corporation land selections, by the nature of ANCSA, had to begin where the village site was. And so if there is contamination on any one of our member entities, you're talking about the most proximate lands to the villages themselves. So in terms of, you know, an intuition of how many of them are, you know, in terms of dire effects to land health, a lot. A lot of them are. How many of them can simply be fenced off and call it good, and that's, you know, that's the extent of it? Not many.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Ms. Biscuit.
So these sites are all identified as being in a cleanup program already. If I talk really loud, I can get through it. there are 94 sites that are not in a program at all, and those are all within 2 miles of a village, and they're all poisoning the food and water source. They're not even in a program yet. So that's important to remember.
I'm curious about something for either Mr. McCowan or Ms. Bissett. We learned that the legacy oil fields, which are in the North Slope, mm-hmm. What you're talking about is much broader, obviously, mm-hmm. But that those are a relic of essentially sort of World War II era, maybe early Cold War activity. What's the origin of these other non-North Slope sites?
It's primarily World War II era. I mean, if you're looking at the bucket, it's you're starting in World War II and you're working through the Cold War. So you have White Atlas sites are a very common category. Radar installations, it runs the gamut of all kinds of for instance, St. George Island, the Pribilofs, we were under NOAA, so it was SEAL service site contamination. You have Coast Guard sites, you have all kinds of DOD sites, so. You pick the federal player, and there's a good chance that they did something at some time.
Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you,
Ms.
A board member with me, Curtis McQueen from McLuta, I'd like him to talk about his site.
Sure.
Close to Anchorage.
Mr. McQueen.
Good afternoon. I'm Curtis McQueen. I'm the CEO of McLuta. Good to see many of you. If you are a representative from Anchorage or the Matsu or all the way up to Chickaloon, you know who we are. One of the impacts, I'll give an example in the Anchorage area. This body, many administrations, have worked very hard for the depletion of king salmon in the north in Cook Inlet. So how do you tie the two? The Eklutna River and where the village of Eklutna was, which goes to Nathan's comment, Camp Mohawk. We are very strong supporters of Jay Bear in the military, so we're on the record of that. We have 17,000 acres due us in Jay Bear. And every time BRACT happens, we say, no, we'll wait, because we support the military. Camp Mohawk is now a FUD site. The Army Corps is in there. They have identified solvents that the old jeeps and the tanks were used to clean back in the days. It has gotten down to a clay layer. It is moving toward the mouth of the Eklutna River. That is a king salmon stream plus all five species. A lot of folks in Anchorage, in the valley, we value our salmon. So not only is that going to have an impact on the Eklutna people, it's going to have an impact on the residents who enjoy fisheries in North Cook Inlet. So there's an example that's affecting Eklutna. We and the Corps have not been able to put a price tag. It is well in the multi-million dollars, and it's right behind the village. They're still trying to figure out how to deal with that. We are supporting the Army Corps to try to seek funding on it, but it is a significant issue.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And back to the slide that's the timeline of those six items. On number, three here, apply EPA policies to ANCSA landholders not to impose landowner liability to federal transferees. And so that's suggesting one of the suggestions was, you know, to remove what you were saying as a barrier for some of them raising their hands. Is that, you know, should that be prioritized ahead of the other things so we get the full extent of the problem first, or is there anything going on with that particular piece of it?
No, thank you, through the chair. That's exactly what one of our federal priorities are. We've been working with the federal delegation to bring about a legislative solution to ensure that the liability, that we have some shield from the liability. Because we believe that's the first real step in addressing the problem, is being able to answer how big and how much. But until we remove that disincentive from reporting, we're going to be in a challenging situation where we could be chasing the rock down the well. You fix 650 sites, now you found 300 more. Well, how many really are there? How much is this really going to clean up? We'd rather get our arms completely around the problem and then be able to address it as need be, by breaking up the various categories of what's easy to clean up, what's harder to clean up, and what ultimately needs to be turned into a Superfund site or needs to be an outright exchange.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
So where we're heading from here is again, we're working with both the state and the federal governments in order to craft a legislative strategy that we think will work to accomplish all this, but also bringing in the relevant departments from the administration level on both the federal and the state side, and trying to knock out as many of the steps of that 6-point plan that the BLM had put together in 1998 as we can. As the private sector, having to push on the public sector in order to accelerate this process. BLM has done a fairly good job over the last 2 years, and we think that we're going to continue to be able to make progress in short order. Anything else you want to talk about? So one thing that we, with our perspective as for-profit corporations, we can come at this with a slightly different perspective on possible solutions. So we've been looking at cleanup credits as an additional way of addressing the problem, being able to the corporations that do have some amount of financial capacity, being able to take action, and then being able to recoup some amount of those dollars via the overall tax program. But that's still very much a work in progress. We're trying to find as many different tools as we can fit into the toolbox.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what a cleanup credit is.
So imagine if you spend $1 million cleaning up a site. We can assume that the site is sufficiently cleaned up, then you can utilize that $1 million as you would any other sort of credit, a depletion credit, net operating loss, any sort, to shield your future income. So essentially it's a way through the tax policy to be subsidizing the cleanups without actually having to have a direct allocation or an appropriation.
In other words, you're expensing the cleanup.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. A follow-up on Representative from Anchorage's question. Is it the full amount, or is it a percentage?
This idea is still very much in its infancy. We haven't made any active proposals, but what we're trying to do is basically throw out things to the various bodies on the federal and state side. We missed with the latest, the federal tax bill, missed anything being able to do it there. But we want to be able to present a notion that we're not looking for the federal government necessarily to step in and take care of it all, that we realize that there's going to have to be a cooperative aspect between us as the landholders and the federal government and the state government.
And also it allows a developer to purchase a cleanup credit versus maybe a wetland mitigation credit, for instance.
Please continue.
Anything else?
Yes. You know, while you're doing that, I just a comment. When I look at the contaminated lands inventory, what's amazing about it, I mean, two things come to mind for me. One is that, for example, I was a history major in high school, and then I taught actually in Kalskag in the Chalista region for 3 years, and I know a bit about history. And so I would expect there to be contaminants in Dutch Harbor or Yakutat or Kodiak. I mean, I'd be surprised if there weren't. Mm-hmm. But because of the war, but I look at these dots and I'm just, it's astonishing. Mm-hmm. I think it also, most of national environmental legislation begins with Lyndon Johnson in about 1965. And ends mostly with Jimmy Carter, with a lot of Richard Nixon in between, signing bill after bill to protect and create the EPA, for example, which Richard Nixon did. Before 1965, there really weren't any national laws. And I know people get frustrated with regulation, but when you don't have it, you end up with this. That's my perspective. It can be overdone, of course. But please continue.
So, in terms of what we're asking from the legislature today, we're looking for legal liability by amending one of the Alaska statutes, as we talked about, being able to take it out of the discretion of DEC and just creating a hard and fast liability shield, but then also to be working with us and working with the various state agencies in order to prioritize the ANCSA-contaminated lands that we have that are closest to human vegetation, and being able to be to working with the task force in order to say which ones are the most immediate, to go back to Representative Parrish's question, which are the most dire cases that are in need of a remediation or action.
And again, Mr. McCowan, on your ask, where you recite to AS 4603-822, is it your understanding that the fear of strict liability, that the state legislature can fix that, mm-hmm. or does it need a national fix?
There's a national fix and a state fix that's
okay.
required.
Okay.
And so we.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Cheesh, that concludes our report.
Thank you.
Ms. Chinan.
Are there questions from the committee? And given that we're happy to adjourn early, but given that people have traveled, if there's something that one of your association members who's traveled would like to make a comment or two, I would welcome that. Or introduce the folks with you.
Through the chair, I'd just like to make one comment.
Say your name again.
Curtis McQueen, Eklutna. We watched development and protection. Please take this group today as the sweet spot story. Here we are supporting development in Alaska. We have a long history of that, including the industry, and we are very proud to be associated. At the same time, we also realize that there is some cleanup and some protections with it. So if there is a party that's in the middle, today we'd like to say we're demonstrating that.
Well, it's a safe place to be. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. I mean, often the middle is the right spot. And so this nation needs a lot of middle right now. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janine Jordan. I am the Vice President at Ganayu Limited, which is the village corporation for Galena, Kaltagnalato, and Kaikuk on the Yukon River. I'm actually going to be speaking on behalf of Unalakleet Native Corporation, though. I'm a Unalakleet tribal member and a shareholder of Unalakleet Native Corporation. Just to provide some perspective on contamination left in Unalakleet because of White Alice sites, in 1958 to 78, the U.S. Air Force operated the North River Radio Relay Station in the Unalakleet area for defense and civilian communications. When the military activity ended, debris and gallons were left all around the site. 55-gallon drums were left behind, saturating the tundra and infecting the local food and water sources. So this was important because there was a river that a lot of the villagers used to get water as well as to go berry picking, hunting, fishing, you name it. And we have some residents who now have diseases that they never had before, like Parkinson's disease. We have one resident, Steven Ivanov, who now has Parkinson's disease. And they are concerned that because of the exposure to the toxins, the PCBs, that this may have contributed to their health and decline in health. So it really is near and dear to our heart with our village corporation and our shareholders that these sites get cleaned up. In Unalakleet, I know that they were cleaned up, but there was still stuff left behind. So even when, you know, environmental impact studies are done and cleanup is done, not everything is taken out. And this is just one of the communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please come forward if you want.
Thank you for this time. Also to the chair for giving us this opportunity. My name is Fritz Sharp. I'm from the village of Twin Hills.
Can you speak up, sir? And
I'm sorry.
And give us your name one more time.
Okay. My name is Fritz Sharp. I'm from the village of Twin Hills. I'm the president of our corporation. And, you know, we're one of the smaller corporations that were formed after 71. We don't even have $1 million, but we do have quite a lot of land. And if there were any contaminations, you know, we couldn't probably even do the study. I know you guys are busy. Thank you for your time and considering this. And I look forward to the results, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. And can you tell me the name of the village again? I couldn't.
Twin Hills.
Twin Hills.
Crystal Bay.
Okay. I thought I'd heard of every village. I don't know that one. Representative Birch.
I just had a question for Richard. Was there any identified? That's okay. I just was curious if have you identified any contaminated areas, or have you had? Has there been any historic activity that would indicate, like, was it, you know, any sort of military activity or anything that might have provided the problem?
Well, for my village, and I was there when it happened. When they built our airport, Brown Construction brought, I know this, I want to say 10,000 gallon drum, big drum, and they were pulling it out, and it's heavy, so it didn't work as they were planning. It fell off the barge, made a big gaping hole, and that thing emptied. And Brown said they only lost 300 gallons, but, you know, they went to Togiak Fish and brought, because we were right there at Togiak Fish, they bought like 6,000 gallons. But this was years ago. That's the only one that I can think of at the time. But the school had, our school is quite a ways from the river, so in order to get to the tanks, they had a line that went to the tanks up at their farm, and for years, I guess, until they noticed it, that was leaking too. So they did some, and then I seen that there's been some work, but I know where the spill site at the landing. When it rains really hard, or that tide comes really high, there's oil seen that can still be seen. So,
thank you. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Please come forward. We're still on your time, meaning we're here to serve. We've got 5 minutes. We're happy to hear from you, or as long as you need.
Hi, I'm from Cake, Alaska, City of Cake. We have a corporation with about 580. So, shareholders?
Yes, and I know you're from Cake, and what is your name?
Bertha Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And we had some concerns about our village. Our village is economically poor right now because we were at one time a village that was a fishing town. And then we went into logging, and the corporations came in, and we had hoped that corporations would help our village, but so many things have happened that, you know, we could not uphold the village on our own. But, on our way up here, we ran into a lady that was working for homeless people. And she said, I want you to put a plug in for some of our homeless people. And some of our homeless people come from the villages because of the economy of the villages. And our plug right now is the fact that, well, with the Cape Tribal Corporation, we just got a new tank farm. And the location, the tank farm, is very beautiful. It's wonderful. It's clean. But the old area has to be cleaned in order for us to, you know, to finish our project. And it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. But because of our economy, we have nowhere to get funding for it. But our thought was maybe to train some of our own people to do the cleanup, and so that they could have jobs available to them. Working in conjunction maybe with the state or federal, it would be nice if some sort of bill was set out there for that, for the purpose of the community.
Thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm. I'm the secretary of our Cape Tribal Corporation. This is our vice president, Jackie.
Please, your name first.
I'm sorry?
Your name first?
Jackie Martin.
Jackie Martin.
Yes, Cape Tribal. I'm vice president. She talked about the little, not a little, an oil spill, or with the old tank farm that we had. I'm pretty positive there's a lot of oil left behind. And I know that we can lobby for help from the state of Alaska, because I told this story several times today. I'm a retired Fed, and we were working with the state of Alaska with Tanana, where Tanana put oil on their streets to keep the dust down. So the state of Alaska came in there and wanted to see if the oil was going down to the watershed. And we came in as a federal government to come in and pick some of that oil sample to see if there was PCB. There was, but the oil going down was going down so slow it did not reach the oil shed, I mean the watershed. So the point is, I know that the feds and the state can work together with this problems throughout the state, and we know that there's a lot of military that has come in and just picked up and left behind a lot of contaminants. And I am hoping, I have hopes that the state will come and help our people throughout the state to help clean up the contaminants left behind. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're about out of time here, but and so it doesn't have to be now, but I know with APU transitioning to become a tribal college, one of the conversations was the kind of about the idea that you mentioned, Ms. Kavanaugh, about you know, how do you have people in villages that have the training, you know, to maintain not just clean up sites, but also, for example, maintain that new tank farm. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if any of you have been involved with that, but that's something I'd like to learn more about, to understand how, you know, that will help fulfill some of the need, and then, you know, what we need to be thinking about at the state level to kind of make it all work better. So if you have any information or have been involved in that, if you could share that with me, that would be really, really helpful. And then the other thing was, I'm just wondering, in terms of economic development, how much having these contaminated sites is limiting opportunity for economic development. You know, do you have locations where you could, you know, build lodges, or, you know, would be, you know, places where people might want to come fish or hunt or anything like that, but it's otherwise, you're otherwise unable to use it right now because it hasn't been cleaned up?
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't affect that area, but it does, you know, there's a handful of people that are with a different mindset of where they want to work. They're not all one-minded where they think tourism is the main thing, but mm-hmm. we do have tourism in Cape as well, but mm-hmm. it's just slowly building, mm-hmm. and we do it with our own corporation. We don't have an outside entity helping us, but we're building ourselves slowly, but at mm-hmm. the same time, we see a need for people to be trained, like for the environmental protection agencies, where if they get the training, they could do the job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, and you mentioned APU, I would like to get more information from you about that, too, as well. So that would help our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCown, I want to thank you and the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. for edifying us and sharing what this concern is and your important testimony. Was there a last comment you wanted to?
No. Okay. I realize time's short. So right. I just want to say thank you to the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to speak here.
Absolutely. We're going to do just some housekeeping for Wednesday, and then we'll adjourn. Please.
And so just want to remind members that the amendments for House Bill 217, the Food Freedom Act, are due today at 5 p.m. That way we can get them distributed tomorrow, and so people will have time to prepare before committee on Wednesday.
Okay. With that, the House Resources Committee adjourns at 3:02.